welcome to the Federal Society's Practice Group podcast. The following podcast, hosted by the Federal Society's International and National Security Law Practice Group, was recorded on Thursday, February 29, 2018, during a live teleform conference call held exclusively for Federal Society members. Welcome to the Practice Group's teleform conference call, as today we consider the Second Circuit Sokolow versus PLO case. I'm Dean Reuter, Vice President, General Counsel, and Director of Practice Groups here at the Federal Society. Please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the expert on today's call. Also, this call is being recorded for use as a podcast in the future and will likely be transcribed. We're very pleased to welcome our special guest, return guest, well-known to most of you on this call, I would think, by now, David Rifkin. He's a partner at Baker Hostetler, a featured contributor to the Wall Street Journal and other publications as well, and a frequent guest here on Teleform. He's going to give us background and his readout on the case in the next 5 to 10 minutes, but as always, we'll be looking to the audience for questions, so please have those in mind. And a special thanks to David Rifkin for joining us when he's suffering through a late winter cold. So with that, David Rifkin, the floor is yours.
Thank you very much, Dean. I apologize for my voice, but it's an interesting case, and I'm glad we can speak about it. The posture basically is as follows. This is a lawsuit that was brought by victims, families of victims of PLO bombings in Israel in the early 2000 period, basically 2002. From 2004, it's a lawsuit brought under an anti-terrorism act of 92 that was meant to deal with this very situation. The lawsuit originated in the Southern District of New York. The plaintiffs prevailed there only to lose in the Second Circuit. Then, having lost in the Second Circuit, they filed a cert petition, and this frequently happens in cases that implicate difficult constitutional issues, particularly involving foreign affairs. The Supreme Court has asked for opinion of a Solicitor General. That opinion was a long time in coming, but it was finally submitted in late February of 2018. In its filing, the Solicitor General's office recommends against granting of cert, and it's been not well received in the media, and was sort of characterized as a kind of a jarring siding by the administration with the PLO. My key point to you all is that it's nothing of a kind. This is, in fact, an instance where the Trump administration, or the Trump DOJ, in particular the Solicitor General's office, is taking a principled constitutional stand. And really, the case is, as I said now, while the lawsuit was brought under the Anti-Terrorism Act, the decisions involved, the Second Circuit decision, has nothing to do really with the merits. It has to do with a very, very important question of personal jurisdiction. Now, not to be pedantic, but personal jurisdiction is a concept that's rooted in the Due Process Clause, both 14th and 5th Amendment. It is an important limitation on the ability of defendants to be hauled into federal courts. That concept, of course, applies in this case. And I think that the Solicitor General's position is entirely correct. Let me just elaborate on this briefly. There are two types of personal jurisdiction. There is general jurisdiction, which arises in a situation where a particular party has been characterized in a couple of different ways, but let's just say has a continuous and systematic activities in a given jurisdiction. Words like feels at home in this jurisdiction have been used. And this is the basis in which the district court found PLO to be subject to general jurisdiction. PLO, of course, has a couple of offices in the United States. If I'm not mistaken, both in New York and D.C. as well as engages in various public diplomacy and other activities. The Supreme Court actually has tightened back in 2014 in the Dima decision the prerequisites for finding of general jurisdiction. And just like the Solicitor General's office, I'm certainly satisfied that while PLO has engaged in various activities here, it did not satisfy the Daimler test for general jurisdiction. Then there is a second type of personal jurisdiction. First, there is specific jurisdiction. Actually, that was not the basis on which the district court found the existence of jurisdiction, but this issue was briefed below. So the Second Circuit concluded that in order for the specific jurisdiction to find, there basically has to be a situation where the actions of a defendant that give rise to liability took place in the jurisdiction or were sufficiently directed at the jurisdiction, and not just directed in a general sense, but where the focal point of those actions impacted the jurisdiction. Obviously, ladies and gentlemen, that test would be satisfied in something like 9/11 attacks that were carried in the United States. That test was not met in a situation where the attacks were carried out in Israel, even though it was predictable that you may have some American victims. As a factual finding in that case, there and that, of course, fact-finding took place at the district court level, and the Second Circuit did not take any issue of it. Most attacks were not directed at the United States. They were directed at Israel, even though it was predictable that there might be American victims. So the test for neither personal nor general, for neither specific nor general jurisdictions having been satisfied, there was no personal jurisdiction in this case, and therefore, no matter how heinous the PLO conduct has been, the merits were not reachable. Now, I mentioned a couple of things again, and I'll stop. What a lot of people don't understand is, including, I'm afraid, a lot of members of Congress who passed Anti-Terrorism Act, ATA of 92, that there's a difference between whether or not a statute is extraterritorial. And that is a statutory interpretation issue, and it's governed by Supreme Court cases, and two in particular, Morrison and R.J. Anabisco, and it requires an explicit statement of congressional intent to do so. The presumption is if such specific statement is lacking, the statute is not extraterritorial. But that's a statutory interpretation issue. The question of personal jurisdiction being a constitutional issue is obviously not something that can be altered for statutory language. Now, a lot of folks, including the amici, congressional amici, were arguing basically that without being able to reach an entity like the PLO, the Anti-Terrorism Act of 92 is essentially ineffectual. Well, first of all, even if it were true, that would not alter the constitutional equities involved, but it's actually factually not true. There may well be attacks carried out overseas, but in a situation where the test of for either general jurisdiction or specific personal jurisdiction would be satisfied. For example, if that were the case, that PLO officers in the United States participated in operational planning or provided financing or some kind of logistical support, we would not be in the situation we're in now. But while PLO provided support, I think the record is pretty clear on that, for those bombings, it was not done by PLO officers in the United States. Or if there was a specific intent by the terrorists, to carry out an attack on American citizens in such a way as to satisfy the test for a specific jurisdiction. So there are circumstances in which the Anti-Terrorism Act of 92 can be operational, exist. They're just not as plentiful as plaintiffs in this case, hope. But in any case, whatever one thinks about the effectiveness of a statute, that does not override the Constitution. And the second thing that, from my perspective, is very important, because one of the important subsidiary issues, but important one in this case, was whether or not PLO is a foreign government, because there's a Supreme Court teaching that United States, states of the United States, are not entitled to due process. And while Supreme Court has never held definitively that that is the case for foreign governments, a couple of circuits, specifically the Second Circuit and the D.C. Circuit, analogized that if American states don't have due process, neither do foreign governments. And the challenges in this case, the plaintiffs pressed the argument that Palestinian PLO being present in the United States and getting various types of U.S. aid and sort of engaging in quasi-government activity as a foreign government. And as G's position entirely correctly was, no, that's not your decision. The decision of whether to recognize somebody as a foreign government is exclusively within the province of executive. Citing, interestingly enough, I suppose you may remember the case of Zavitovsky, that was a Jerusalem passport case that reaffirmed the proposition that it is very much exclusively the prerogative of Article 2, specifically the president, to recognize foreign governments. So I think due process issues and personal jurisdiction issues aside, this case was very good in reaffirming, I think, a clear constitutional proposition as to whether the Article 2 prerogatives in this area. Well, let me stop here and see where we go.
Very good. Thank you so much, David. In a moment, we'll all hear an announcement that will say the floor mode is on. After you hear that announcement, if you have a question for our guest, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. So once again, if you have a question, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. Let me go just one step deeper in one of your hypotheticals regarding jurisdiction. And well, let me ask you this first. As a preliminary, jurisdiction is a preliminary question. It really goes to the power of the court to hear a case. Is it that fundamental? Is that why personal jurisdiction is such an important constitutionally anchored principle?
Yes, Dean. Well, they're sort of, let me put it this way. The most fundamental question in our constitutional system for Article III court is a subject matter jurisdiction, which goes to the overarching ability of Article III to adjudicate the disposition of certain disputes. That's sort of a threshold question, and that issue cannot be waived. So even if you have lawyers who have not figured it out and did not bring it, there's no way where you can raise it any time. Personal jurisdiction is also very important, but is waivable if it's not raised at an appropriate time. But it really is, it's anchored in the due process clause of both Fifth Amendment, which of course deals with the federal government, 14th Amendment deals with states. So it is a question of really liberty. It's the question of an ability of federal courts to impact particular individuals or particular entities, particular organizations. So it is important, but as I said, it's a little different lane than subject matter jurisdiction.
Now, again, for our audience, if you have a question, push the star button, then the pound button on your telephone. Our lines are wide open. Going a little further into one of your hypotheticals, if the attack here had involved a U.S. embassy or even in a military base within Israel or somewhere abroad, would the jurisdictional analysis come out differently then?
Yes, I very much believe so. I think that, again, let's say their attack came, and in a hypothetical, there are no PLO offices here at all. So it was in town, or PLO offices, as the case here, did not have anything to do operationally, financially, with their attack. It was carried out by PLO assets overseas. But yes, if you are attacking the U.S. embassy, you can certainly be an additional being criminally liable, and hopefully you'll be captured and brought back as, for example, happened with the attackers on USS Cole in Yemen. You'll be brought back and tried in a criminal prosecution, and there could be civil cases brought against you by the victims or victims' families. So that would be that clearly would be a different situation, which is, again, makes perfect sense. The law in this area is actually quite logical, Dean, which is not always the case with a case law.
One thing that, and again, if you're in the audience, if you have a question, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. We've got plenty of time for questions. One thing that might not sound, I don't know if logical is the right word, but maybe counterintuitive, the idea, this notion that, if I heard you correctly, foreign entities have constitutional and due process rights in U.S. courts, foreign entities meaning foreign corporations and other entities. Foreign governments, however, apparently don't. Does that seem... give us your readout on that, if you would.
Sure. Well, first, we're not talking about foreign persons or foreign entities having constitutional rights overseas. It's pretty clearly established that they do not. Remember, where the context here is we're talking about foreign persons, foreign entities being dragged into U.S. courts. Being dragged into U.S. courts, obviously, you have the rights that attach in fact, in some sense, by analogy, is if you are physically present in the United States, you have constitutional rights. Point number one. Point number two, I am not a big fan. I'm a pragmatic litigator. I understand that the Supreme Court doctrine is that American states do not have due process rights because they're not persons within the meaning of a due process clause. And as I said earlier in my opening remarks, by analogy, foreign governments are not persons in the meaning of a due process clause and do not have due process rights. I happen to think, and the only two circuits, really, the D.C. Circuit in a case called Livnot and the Second Circuit in a case called Fonterra, have held that that foreign governments do not have due process rights. I happen to think it's... I recognize the case law. If I were litigating this, I would of course acknowledge this. But I happen to think conceptually that does not make any particular sense. The Supreme Court, by the way, held that American states are not persons and therefore do not have due process rights in a case called South Carolina versus Katzenbach that dates back to 1966. It is what it is, but I think conceptually it makes no sense because, among other things, it would mean that the federal government is suing states in federal courts, which happened quite a bit both during the Obama administration and seems to be happening even more frequently during the Trump administration. That means that, as a constitutional matter, states have not only no due process rights sort of writ large, but they have no right to any notice or opportunity to be heard. Now, the only rights they have are the ones that accrue by virtue of, you know, federal rules of civil procedure that essentially are statutorily based. And they're, you know, quite plentiful, but it would be jarring to consider that if Congress wanted to prune the rights of states by changing federal rules of civil procedure, but the states would have no opportunity to get notice or not be entitled to be heard. I happen to think it is not a very good conclusion, but it is what it is. We just have to recognize that.
Right. Back to this case in particular. And again, if you're in the audience, if you have a question, push the star button, then the pound button on your telephone. I see now somebody's just weighed in with a question. We'll go to them in a second. But one quick question you might or might not know the answer to. You mentioned that the Department of Justice through the Office of Legal Counsel came in recommending against a grant of cert, looking at the principles here, regardless of the sympathy they might have for the plaintiffs. Did they consult the State Department in a matter like this, or do you know?
Well, I don't know what happened specifically in this case, but it is quite common for Department of Justice to consult with the State Department in matters bearing upon foreign policy, but I certainly have, you know, strong conviction that in a matter of constitutional interpretation, It is first and last DOJ and particularly Solicitor General's office, you know, and appropriate. And then we'll consult within the department, Office of Legal Counsel, you know, possibly other divisions. But, yeah, I mean, again, this is not an instance where policy had a lot to do with it.
Right.
So this is everything to do with the Constitution. And it's a very nicely written brief, by the way. So I salute Bravo Francisco.
Interesting. Now two questions pending. So let's pause here and take our first question from the audience. Go right ahead, caller.
I did not have it on mute, so I wasn't sure. I'm not an attorney, so you'll have to bear with me. It is possible, isn't it, for U.S. nationals to get at the assets of foreign governments in the United States for wrongs committed against them? Is that true?
And that's not entirely true. Getting at the assets is a different question from personal jurisdiction, but yes. Well, let me back up. You cannot really get at the sovereign assets of a foreign country because of, to the extent the foreign sovereign immunity, which is a statutory vehicle, applies. That's sort of point number one. There is one exception to this rule, one exception to this situation. Congress back in 2016 passed something called JUSTA, which specifically waived foreign sovereign immunity. It really does not say that explicitly, but that was done in the context of going after states that allegedly were involved in supporting 9/11 hijackers. So you generally cannot get at assets belonging to a foreign sovereign. You can get at, but again, it's a little technical, cannot get at the sovereign assets. You can get at, so you cannot seize a warship. You cannot seize an embassy. You can get at the commercial property, perhaps. But what you may be thinking about is the my whole discussion about personal jurisdiction arises in the context of a jurisdiction over persons. That's why it's called personal. There's other type of jurisdiction called in rem or quasi in rem jurisdiction. So if there is an asset in the United States that is not a sovereign asset, which cannot be touched because of foreign sovereign immunity, a commercial asset, that asset can be a basis for in rem jurisdiction and can indeed be seized.
So is that the case with Cuba?
Well, again, if there is a commercial, well, look, it's a complicated issue. I hate to sound like a damn lawyer, but there are a number of instances where there are efforts to seize otherwise seizable assets that belong to foreign governments that have done various wrongs. It involved Cuba. It involved Iran. It involved going back to the early post-Civil War in Russia days, the fact that Russia defaulted on various bonds that they issued. Typically, those cases are resolved in the context of a diplomatic settlement. And indeed, the Russian claims were settled on something called the Litvinov assignment. The Iranian claims were settled in the context of a deal that the United States signed with Iran. And the same, I believe, was done in regard to Cuba much, much more recently. So the short answer is anything aside from the foreign sovereign immunity issues, you cannot just go in and try to seize an asset that belongs to a foreign entity without checking to see if those types of claims have been disposed of by your government. And it's been challenged. You can say to me, why is it that the United States government is able to dispose of the claims that I, as an individual, may want to vindicate? Well, let me just say this issue has been litigated, and the people who felt that the government could not settle their claims were lost.
Is there a point at which a terrorist organization becomes the agents of a state, and then more liability can be put to that? Or would that still be the U.S. taking the issue to the world court and blaming the sovereign government, or?
No. I'm a little confused. If the United States wants to strip away sovereign immunity, which is granted by statute, they can, which is what happened with Justin. And as you may know, there has been a lawsuit brought by the families of the people who died during 9/11, and they brought a lawsuit against Saudi Arabia in the Southern District of New York. And that lawsuit, while not resolved definitively, at least the preliminary phase, the plaintiffs have won. They got the district court in Manhattan to reject Saudi Arabia's claims, rejected their motion to dismiss. So this lawsuit is going forward. So there are certainly circumstances where, I mean, if the United States wants to make a given foreign sovereign liable, they can easily strip away foreign sovereign immunity either by statute, like JUSTA, or it can have a statute that enables the president to designate countries as sponsors of terrorism that would affect a waiver of immunity. So there are many ways to proceed, but when you say world court, I mean, I'm not aware of anybody doing that, certainly in the recent past. But yes, if the United States can take the position that a foreign country that carries a terrorist attack against an American embassy, American warship, American nationals, has committed an act of war, and assuming that country has subjected itself to ICJ jurisdiction, which is done by treaty, can bring a case in ICJ, but that's typically not what we would do.
Okay, thank you very much.
Sure.
We still have some time left. If you'd like to ask a question, push the star button, then the pound button on your telephone. Just one question pending, so let's turn to our next caller.
Yes, Mr. Ripken, it's David Emerson with the Berkeley Federalist Society chapter. Thank you for your remarks. A question for you about on personal jurisdiction and whether or not that you get a sense of either directly or indirectly through the briefs or the court's decisions, whether or not it considers whether or not the petitioners have reasonable access to justice in another forum other than the court that they're appealing to. And I guess what lies behind that question is the assumption that the general sense of extraterritorial jurisdiction and the discouragement of that is that there is justice to be found elsewhere. And there's no need for the U.S. to be intervening in matters of other states if someone could just go to those other states and expect to get justice. So my question has to do with whether the courts take this into account in their reasoning. And if they don't, is there a court of last resort? Is there a supra-international body which has something, the counterpart of the Anti-Terrorism Act, under which these petitioners can seek relief?
Right. Well, I would say that the question of whether you have a recourse in another court does not really enter into the paradigm for determining either general personal jurisdiction or specific personal jurisdiction. I say that even though there is language in both tests that uses words like reasonable under circumstances, and I'm loosely quoting from a general jurisdiction type cases, under the circumstances in a particular case to exercise jurisdictional defendant in the context of a specific jurisdiction, there words about fairness. So yes, there's a little bit of a wiggle room, I would say, as far as the judicial ability, given that language, to sort of look a little beyond just the extent of your contacts or the your ability to argue that that your tortious acts were directed at the jurisdiction, or jurisdiction was the focal point for them. but it really is not particularly relevant here. You may be thinking about other doctrines like forum nonconvenience, where you could say, well, look, yes, personal jurisdiction may be met, but this is really not the best, you know, court to proceed with. So I would say it gets captured under, you know, forum nonconvenience, which is essentially a much more discretionary exercise of authority by Article 3. And again, it makes sense. I mean, basically, if you think about it in terms of, you know, domestic litigation, if you live in California, but you have sufficiently availed yourself of, you know, presence, given your presence in New York, of the laws of New York and of continuous activities in New York, there's general jurisdiction of you in New York. The fact that you really, really don't want to litigate in New York because you don't want to, let's say New York law is not great from your perspective, or you just rather do it in California. The fact that it may be more convenient to you does not vitiate the facts that enable the plaintiffs to reach you in New York. Bottom line being, you voluntarily, nobody forced you into this, you voluntarily chose to be sufficiently present in New York, either for purposes of general jurisdiction or you've done enough to satisfy the specific personal jurisdiction test. So a long answer, but the availability of other fora, other venues would not really signify, and properly so.
Let me make a final call for questions. If you have a question, push the star button and then the pound button on your phone. I believe we've had our final question. Let me give you a chance to wrap up. In doing so, David Rifkin, if you could let us know. I mean, in my experience, the court will often follow the advice of the Solicitor General. Here you've noted that the Solicitor General recommends against cert grant, which is a position you think is perfectly defensible, indeed the right decision, or the right position. Any predictions on whether or not there will be a cert grant here? How do you analyze that?
Zero, both for the reason you mentioned, but also because there are a couple of creative arguments that the petitioners have put on the table, including the argument that PLO really is a sovereign state, but it's sovereign state, a foreign government. It's not, but what's important, and the Supreme Court, by the way, again, as I said a couple of times now, is not definitively ruled on whether foreign governments are persons or not, and are not entitled to the due process protections. But the Solicitor General points out correctly that, I hate to use Latin words, that PLO is sui generis or sui generis. So it is not the best vehicle for reaching this issue. Why is PLO sui generis? Well, some people in this call may know it better than I do, but PLO is a very unusual relationship with the United States. It does have offices here. It is entitled to some immunities. It interacts a lot with U.S. government, receives a lot of U.S. government money. So it's kind of one of a kind. So to the extent that the Supreme Court wants to definitively dispose of the issue of whether or not foreign governments are persons, the meaning of a due process clause, this is not the right vehicle. And last but not least, this is in addition to the more pragmatic observation, I think, Dean, that you just made, which is when the Solicitor General urges the court not to accept cert, it puts a heavy thumb on the scale. But in addition to that, there's a point I made about this being the wrong vehicle, and the fact that contrary to what the party seeking cert alleged, there's really no circuit split. The D.C. Circuit and the Second Circuit that for squarely reached those issues are in unison. So I would be bold and, you know, instead of saying almost zero, I would say zero.
Anything about, one final question, anything, any insights into the time frame here? Is this something the court will dispose of quickly, or they'll sit on it till the end of the term, or any sense of that?
I would say they should, I think they should do so. I mean, whenever they're, again, I don't know what, when is the next conference coming up for considering cert petitions? I just have not been tracking it. But, yeah, I don't expect that it would take a a long time for the cert denial to issue. I think the issues are pretty clear. And let me also speculate that I don't think there would be any dissents from a cert denial. But I'm not sure of that.
That's pretty definitive. Well, I want to thank you, David Rifkin, for your time. This is something sort of on the breaking news category, although we didn't do this as a courthouse step, certainly concerns the latest goings-on at two levels of court. So I appreciate you making time for us today, especially given the status of your health and your voice. I also want to thank our audience for dialing in and for your thoughtful questions. A reminder about our next scheduled teleforum conference call. That's 3 p.m. tomorrow. We'll be talking, this will be Courthouse Steps, talking about a case heard yesterday, the Bosinek case. That's the second partisan gerrymandering case heard so far this term. That will be tomorrow again at 3 p.m. Eastern Time at this same number. But until that next call, we are adjourned. Thank you very much, everyone. Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this Practice Group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at fedsoc.org/multimedia.